Crime Curious is a true crime podcast that takes an in-depth look into real cases through the lens of a trained investigator and former prosecutor turned judge.
If you are sensitive to expletives, anatomical descriptions, and accurate descriptions of crime scenes, this podcast may not be suitable for you.
Have you or someone you love been a victim of a crime that's still unsolved? Crime Curious has teamed up with one of the top private investigation services in the Indiana and surrounding area. If you have listened to us long enough, you know that we do not seek out services or products that are meaningless to us or hold no real value. So you can trust us when we say that Corbett Investigations comes with decades of experience you won't find anyplace else. Corbett Investigations is run by a former homicide commander of one of the country's most successful homicide units, has put over 400 people in prison for homicide, handled over 1,100 death investigations, and solved 33 cold case murders. To be real with you, Mr. Corbett had a really difficult time telling us what we should highlight in this segment because he does not like to sound like he's bragging. Solving crimes has been his life's passion, and he has never done it for the accolades or recognition. He has a whole team behind his services that help him be so successful, as they specialize in things like bloodstain analysis, ballistics, crime scene reconstruction, and forensic pathology, just to name a few. When you contact Corbett Investigations, you talk directly with Tim Corbett. He is hands-on with every case and can travel anywhere that's needed to get the job done. Corbett Investigations prides itself on honesty, truth, feet to the ground, real investigation work, and the strength to stand up to whatever is in the way of solving the crime. Corbett Investigations specializes in complex homicide cases, sex offenses, and criminal investigations that are old and new. Tim and his team have a reputation for finding witnesses and information that others could not. Although we hope none of our listeners ever need private investigation services, if you do, we recommend contacting Corbett Investigations and mention this segment on Crime Curious for a free consultation. Contact Tim Corbett today at 574-229-8115. You can also check them out on Facebook at Corbett Investigative Services, Inc. Thanks for listening, and now on to the show. Welcome to Crime Curious. I'm Charnel, and I almost said I'm Megan, and I've never been Megan.
But I'm Megan.
Yeah, I'm still Charnel.
You can be both of us.
I was looking at you, okay, and that's why I almost said your name.
Which personality am I talking to today?
It's very hard to say.
Is it Charnel? Do I have Charnel?
I think you've got Charnay today.
I like Charnay.
Yeah, Charnay is fun. Hi, friend. This is a general episode. We just got done recording a bonus episode for our Patreons.
So. And it was a little spooky. So far, if you aren't a Patreon, you've missed a story about kind of a weird vampire-y guy who drank blood. So that was where the vampire part came from. I'm so smart. Sometimes I amaze myself. And then a naughty nun.
A naughty nun.
So if you're interested in naughty nuns and vampires, as I am.
Yes, join Patreon. Join Patreon. Get the bonus content. And we have to remember this is a general audience, so we should probably tone it down. But in the meantime, let's shake our sack of dicks.
That's just what a great way to start.
That's how we tone it down. And
Squeaker Pig has come from many, many episodes now of fans sending us lucky objects.
If this is your first episode with us, first of all, welcome. Hi.
Welcome to Crime Curious.
And we have lots of good luck charms sent in by our listeners that we shake, rattle, roll, and squeak at the beginning of each episode.
This is a safe space.
Brings us good juju.
For us, not you.
And, that's right. Sometimes I don't even feel safe. So
Cool. You will find that as this case is being presented, I will give input and there will be banter. And if you don't like any of that, Dateline is available to you 24/7 on Netflix.
Sure is. All right, are you ready to hear about David freaking Frank Spanbauer?
Is that his actual name?
That's his actual name.
I've always wanted to use freaking in a name.
I added the freaking.
Oh, okay.
But David Frank Bauer? I feel like that's just how we need to call him. He's just David freaking Frank Spanbauer.
Okay.
All right, he's a real shithead.
Can we just call him the shithead?
We sure can. Because we don't give a crap about his name, right? Nope. Shithead Spanbauer.
Perfect.
Perfect ring to it, right? He was born into a blue-collar German Catholic family in January of 1941 in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
I love Wisco cases. Yeah. Those people are my people. They are salt of the earth.
They are.
They can withstand the cold. Their alcohol consumption would kill everybody else in the continental United States, including Alaska. I said it. I said what I said.
They're bred different.
They are.
Real different. What they remind me of?
Vikings.
Well, yes, but also if you've ever traveled to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, yeah, which is connected,
it's Swedish,
by the way, to Wisconsin.
It is.
They're very
similar.
They
try to take
breed.
It back all the time. They still claim it should be theirs.
Also, it probably should. It's really inconvenient to cross that big ass bridge.
I refuse to give it back. I love it. It's beautiful. And I love Wisconsin.
Yeah. But they're built different. They can drink like my husband's family is from up there. And the first time that I went up and visited, I was shook at the amount of beers. Everyone takes a turn buying a round of beer.
Charnel.
Oh, girl.
I like going to Wisconsin because I'm considered slender there, okay?
Beautiful. But you are beautiful.
These are voluptuous, gorgeous women, and they make me look slender. Like, I look at myself and go, I need to pack a little more in the back to be able to keep up with this lining Kugel drinker.
No, they're fantastic. Now, Frank.
So Oshkosh, Wisconsin, but we have shithead David Frank.
Yeah, we have shithead David Frank, who is not cool. We don't like him at all. And it's unfortunate that he was born in Wisconsin.
You know this fucker drinks Busch, even though he's access to Spotted Cow. And only you people from Wisconsin got that, and that's okay.
Yep. Now, he and his father did not have a good relationship. His dada was hard on him being the oldest and the only son because he had two younger sisters. They never got a chance to reconcile their relationship either because when David was 14 years old, his father passed away from a heart problem. Okay. Also, I forgot to say, thank you, Patreon Heather, for today's suggestion. Sorry, I can't believe I skipped right over that. How rude of me.
That's okay.
Should we get
an
extra pipsqueak for Heather.
Thank you, Heather.
Yeah. Okay. And thank you for being a Patreon and keeping us creating for you. Anywho, back to the regular scheduled programming. So here he is, doesn't like his daddy, never gets a chance to reconcile with his daddy, who is pretty hard on him, which, you know, he was born in 1941. So I think that's pretty common I know that's pretty common for the times.
It was. Children weren't always loved and cuddled a lot at that point in time. They were meant to obey.
Well, they were raised by PTSD parents from post-war eras. Okay. So, you know, that happens. But so his father passes away when he's 14, and this kind of results in David not being a stranger to the juvenile court system. There's a whole rap sheet on him.
So this is in like the late 50s or mid to late 50s as a teenager then that he becomes a part of the juvenile court system.
About 1955.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
So he drops out of Oshkosh High School just after his 17th birthday, and he joins the Navy. He did not do so well in the Navy, as I'm sure you, as a previous juvenile court expert.
I have a ton of kids who do fantastic in military service and get recruited right out of there from having had maybe bad home lives or having committed some petty type things.
Yeah.
But if you get somebody who has either a narcissistic personality or really some type of oppositional defiance, well, you're not going to do well in the Navy or the Army or the Marines, where people literally fucking tell you what to do all the time, when you can do it, when you can eat, when you can shit.
Well, and you hit it on the head with the ODD. Like, he definitely has oppositional defiance disorder. And he actually had 3 court-martials for being absent without leave and spent 7 months in the brig.
Yeah.
His mother received a letter from naval doctors saying that he needed psychiatric care. There's no mention as to why of this, but they just saw enough of him that they felt that he needed the psychiatric care. So he received a dishonorable discharge and returned to Wisconsin in November of 1959. Next, he actually goes back to Oshkosh High School to pick up where he left off, but his mental health issues lead him to what is described as his first criminal major event of his life. On January 3rd, 1960, he broke into a home in Appleton and made his way with 2 diamond rings, a hunting knife, a bottle of booze, and some cash, and a .22 handgun.
Okay, a little petty home invasion. He stole booze, guns, and jewelry.
Yeah.
But no harm. He didn't harm anyone.
He did not harm anybody. Nope.
Unoccupied home, most likely, at the time?
Yes. The next night, in the next town over from Oshkosh, he robbed a home with his new pistol. Now, this time the people were home, and he just kind of held them at gunpoint and took the cash. So this is his
start. He's escalating, though.
Yes.
Real quick. This is his
start, and it only gets worse from here. A week later in Appleton, David, who's 19 years old at this time, breaks into a home wearing a mask. So now we're fucking creepy. The homeowner, I mean, I know they don't want, he doesn't want them to know their identity, but that masks creep me out.
Well, he didn't wear a mask the first two times. The first time, because presumably there was no one there. The second time, well, that was just stupid.
It was, yes.
Because people can identify you.
Uh-huh. So the third time he was like, oh, let me get smarter. I should put on a mask.
You're already a suspect, but okay.
Mm-hmm. The homeowner was a woman who was asleep in her bedroom.
Oh.
While her 13-year-old daughter was awake studying. He flashed the pistol at the girl and hauled her out behind the garage after stealing cash, any of the cash that he could find from the home. And this is a trigger alert to sexual assault. He told the 13-year-old girl, I'm going to rape you. She says, what does that mean? And instead of answering, shithead David slaps her twice. This results in the girl screaming, and that attracted the attention of someone that was walking by the house. So this person starts to investigate, and he runs off and drives towards Green Bay.
So he didn't actually sexually assault her?
No, he did.
He was thwarted because she screamed.
Yes, he was attempting to. He had a hold of her forcibly without her against her will.
So that's an actual crime in Michigan, and I think Wisconsin is similar. It's called assault with intent to commit sexual penetration.
Yep, yep. So he heads off towards Green Bay. And his next crimes happened on January 12th, 1960. Now, just to help you like keep track of the time here, it was January 3rd, 1960 that he tries these home invasions, okay? So just a few days later, now he's going to keep going. There was a 16-year-old girl who was babysitting her cousins. As she was playing the piano, shithead David lurks outside and is watching her through a window. Ugh.
I know.
Armed with his pistol, he enters the house and pocketed a small amount of cash that he found. He forced the teenage girl into a bedroom, forced her down, again, trigger alert, forced her legs open, and slashed her clothes apart with his knife. Remember the knife that he stole from the first home invasion?
Yes.
With that knife.
Did he injure, or was he just cutting her clothes away for the purposes of rape?
Yes, he was cutting her clothes away, and he does sexually assault her. Her uncle returned in the middle of all this. David takes that .22 handgun that he had stole, shoots him in the face, and flees from the house.
Did he die? I know that's a stupid question, but sometimes people live.
No, he lived.
Oh, it wasn't a stupid question.
Yep, he did live, but albeit, I'm sure, not
great.
You know, the same. Yeah, yeah. And from what I hear, getting shot in the face hurts.
Yeah.
So since his first burglary, when he got the handgun, he bounced around the southeastern Wisconsin area for almost a month and a half, being undetected. There is a record of an attempted robbery near Milwaukee.
I was just going to say, so he's down near Milwaukee, which is also close to northern Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And he was actually picked up for carrying a concealed firearm in Sheboygan County.
Yep.
On February 16th.
Their Sheboygan's with an S. Ours is with a C.
It is. Yep. Theirs is actually spelled the way where it makes so much more sense.
Phonetic.
It is Sheboygan, mm-hmm. where ours does not sound, is not spelled at all.
Ours
it
is ch.
It is.
Sheboygan.
It's Sheboygan, but it's still pronounced with Sheboygan.
With a soft C.
Well, it's kind of like my name.
Yeah.
My name is not.
Charnel.
When it's pronounced Charnel. Mm-hmm. My parents got into a whole fight about it. It's a thing. Anywho. So February 16th. So he really started the beginning of January and is already picked up by February 16th for carrying a concealed firearm. He doesn't handle the pressure well.
There has been attempted murder here, by the way, too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
He doesn't handle the pressure well, and he broke down in police custody. Remember, the military thought he needed psychiatric care. So this doesn't really surprise me. He starts babbling like confessions of a teenage drama queen, and all the stories that I just told you come out his mouth to the police. In court, the judge labeled him as a sexual deviant and sentenced him to 70 years in prison.
Wow. Wow. I am amazed because you have a judge in the 60s in conservative small town Wisconsin who gave somebody 70 years for sexually assaulting a girl.
A 19-year-old.
That's amazing. That's a great sentence.
Honey, I'm only on page 2 of 10 of this research, so.
So it's not going to go well from here. Because that's not the end. You don't get to say, and he died in prison.
And now it's time for a bring back. 50 years later,
and it's time.
Nope.
But could you? Could we just do that?
I wish we could. I wish, because it gets so much worse. Okay. And from a legal standpoint, you're really going to hate some shit that goes down. You really are.
If it doesn't end here, I hate it.
Yeah, it does not. So David Spanbauer, age 19, Wisconsin convict, sexual deviant, the end, like supposed to be in prison for 70 years. During his prison time, David's mother, Evelyn, hammered authorities with letters encouraging her son's release at his parole hearings, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah.
He was mentally disturbed and no one ever helped him.
Yes. She even wrote the governor, Warren Knowles, and claimed that her son was not a pervert and that David's conviction was a result of the rape victim being a seductive and wanton woman.
Fuck that.
Yeah, Evelyn.
You broke into her house with intent after having already intended to sexually 16. Assault other young girls.
Yeah. Yeah, Evelyn can kick rocks. I'm sorry, but no. And she also described that her precious David was poor and weak. Now remember, he was a 19-year-old adult.
Military trained, dishonorably discharged because of his behavior.
Yes. And he raped a 16-year-old innocent girl while she was playing the piano.
And attempted to rape a 13-year-old one, but a passerby stopped it from happening.
For sure. Yeah. So like I said, Evelyn, go kick rocks.
And why is he still not serving 70 years?
So his mother's efforts were useless. Prison officials constantly suspected him of homosexual liaisons with other inmates, which whatever.
Good for you. I don't care.
Who cares?
On the inside, do whatever, as long as it was consensual.
Their problem, the prison officials' problem, were that it was especially with young prisoners.
So well, presumably they only have adults in there. But.
I don't know. Because the ones that are tried as adults that aren't really adults.
Fair. But isn't he pretty young still too?
He's 19.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They also noted that he was intelligent, a good worker, but he had a vicious temper.
Probably when someone told him to do something he did not want to do.
Yes. During his 1971 parole hearing, David had an outburst during his parole hearing and later claimed that he had no control over what he said. While in prison, he got a tattoo of a devil on his forearm as a way of foreshadowing what was going to come, I am sure of it.
Sir, why couldn't you have just got an angel on the other arm and then you could have like tried to get this one to rise above?
Also, why would you give yourself such a distinctive tattoo?
Well, it's a mark or a badge of honor and pride in prison.
It was pretty big from what I understand.
Okay, well, at least something was.
So David, yeah, that's about the only thing. David was released in May of 1972 after serving 12 years of his 70-year sentence.
He made parole.
Yep.
So did he must have clearly been able to keep himself calm enough with the parole board?
There was something to do about, you know, sentences and the length of time and time served things that I was like, what the fuck ever. He got out after 12 years and none of this matters because they don't do it that way anymore. This was 1972.
Okay.
But he had served a certain percentage of his sentence and that was really at the time what was expected when.
Good behavior.
You get that sentence.
I know. Okay. So not even necessarily good behavior, just served in a certain percentage of time and at the time in Wisconsin for state prison system.
Yes.
You qualify for parole.
Right, because he had served that minimum amount of his lengthy sentence. Yes, this was a very common occurrence then. So he decides he's going to go to college at Madison Area Technical College and maintained a B average while living at the YMCA at the University of Wisconsin campus in Madison.
Okay.
All right, so like he's trying here. but he quickly became entangled in the local crime scene. He let an escaped prisoner borrow his car.
I mean, a friend in need.
Yes.
It's a friend indeed.
And the fugitive was arrested after a robbery in nearby Middleton.
Not my fault, just my car.
So at this point in time, he's violating his parole, though. Because he is having communication with other criminals.
Correct.
And let them use his car.
And engaging in conspiracy, uh-huh. which is a criminal behavior.
So he's super close to going back to prison. And for being involved in this robbery case, he did do some time in the Dane County Jail, but was able to get out with what was called the Huber Law working privileges at the time. So he could get out to work. Yeah, exactly. And he worked. Oh, this is such a bad idea. He worked for the Madison Parks Department. Yeah. So David worked the parks and the city beaches in the hot summer sun of 1972.
Around young people in bathing suits?
Yep. I fucked the bikini-clad women lying in the sun. This is not the right fit for someone who had just done over a decade in
for
prison
a sexually
for
motivated
sexual
offense.
Crimes. Yep. I don't think I need to tell anyone that his fantasies were running wild and the urges were intense, and he clearly has no self-control. That frontal lobe, not developed. Because of his work with the Parks Department, he knew most of the secluded places to take his next victim. She was a 17-year-old waitress out hitchhiking. He picked her up on Highway 51 by brandishing a knife and drove while he was actually driving to the park. He told her that he was going to rape her, and when he was through with her, he would run her over with his car and toss her body in the ditch. She started crying. David started crying along with her. This was August 11th, 1972, because there's nothing worse than being abducted, held against your will at knife point and told you're going to be raped, but then to have your assailant bawling along with you, that's too much. No.
I don't know how I would react.
Well, he tied her up. He tied her hands, actually, so she couldn't, like, get away, and he sexually assaulted her. But he does let her go.
Yes, she connected with him.
Yes. Well, they were
connected.
Crying together.
I know. He couldn't kill her.
Yeah. She told the police that the man had a tattoo of a devil on his forearm. And later, when David was rounded up as a suspect, she identified him as the man who had raped her. David tried to play it all off. In his eyes, they got along fine.
It's consensual.
Everything was cool. They had consensual sex. They had a good cry together. I mean, you know, it was beautiful. It was a beautiful coupling in David's eyes.
He was in love.
So he has found, he's found guilty for abduction and rape. And the assistant district attorney, John Burr, asked for the maximum sentence of 50 years on top of what David would receive for violating his parole. Because remember,
up to the maximum term of your sentence.
He hasn't even been out for a year.
No.
And here we are doing this again.
Yes.
Later, he actually told psychiatrists that he did what he did out of sexual frustration and he simply couldn't wait any longer. He said to a social worker that he was asocial and must have been born, this is not my word, this is his direct quote, born retarded.
That was a normal term.
Oh, it was. Yes.
Cognitive impairment then.
It was. But I'm going to give you a trigger warning, but it's not to the general public. It's a trigger warning to you, Megan.
Oh, my.
For judicial justification that you're not going to resonate with.
I'm going to sit back and be quiet.
Okay.
I'm going to stroke this dormouse.
All right. With all the facts of the case before him, Judge Richard Bardwell reasoned that the rape was much more mild than David's previous rape, the one where he had tied the victim down, spread eagle, raped her at knife point, and then blasted another man in the face with a handgun because he was interrupted. Therefore, the judge figured that David Spanbauer had moved from being a very dangerous sex offender to now merely just dangerous, so there has been some improvement. He noted that David was still a sociopath, but his tendencies weren't so severe. So Bardwell gave David 12 years in prison that ran concurrent with his revoked parole. He said the girl was, you're going to hate this, it's going to make us all gag. This is a quote from the judge. The girl was in effect asking for it because she was hitchhiking. Mm-hmm. Quote, They are attempting fate when they do it, end quote. He actually said the girl was in effect asking for it. They are attempting fate when they do it.
So I'm familiar, I think, a little bit then with this case, or at least from that judicial opinion. It's been something that has been brought up really many times in different judicial trainings. And
as what not to do?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the primary cases where the whole look how she's dressed thing came from. So she was asking for it because she was in that situation.
Right, because she was hitchhiking. Yes. She asked for a ride, not a rape.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Any time when you go off someplace with a guy and it's the whole thing with the rape, like, well, what did you expect? Like drinking and stuff? Well, I expected a hangover. I didn't expect to be sexually assaulted.
Absolutely.
And yes. So, I mean, I'm not going to freak out as much as you would think I am because I'm familiar with this. Well, it actually doesn't surprise me.
Figured you'd know given the time.
Well, his whole logic is just so flawed. Yes. In that I am actually concerned intelligence-wise for what we were as a people then, or at least maybe some of the male judicial officials were, because instead of looking at the obvious, and that is his behavior is escalating because he's perpetrating additional sexual offenses while he's under supervision, which actually even makes him more dangerous.
He's on work release.
He took a sexual assault and found a couple, well, he didn't necessarily use as vicious of a weapon this time, and no one ended up getting shot in the face. Yeah, because no one tried
because
to save
no
her.
Because no one interrupted.
Because no one interrupted him. He was able to complete his sexual offense.
Right. So what? He's on work release for crying out loud. And in parole.
And on parole.
So we're, yes. Hold that on. Conviction. Like, think about this completely. He's on parole from his first 70-year sentence that he only served 12 years of. And then was on work release because he was doing time in the county jail for being associated with another crime by letting an escaped prisoner take his vehicle, okay, or borrow his vehicle for a robbery.
Where
okay.
He conspired.
Yeah, so he's on work release and picks up this woman and sexually assaults her. Like, it's just so gross. So, Assistant District Attorney Burr thought that David Spanbauer was a threat to society and was enraged by the light sentence. Yes, rightfully so. Burr later said that David Spanbauer was, quote, in the top 10 of the most vicious and violent people I've ever had the displeasure of coming in contact with.
I believe that too.
Yep. So David gets even more savvy in his sociopathic behavior. He has learned to manipulate the system. So he asked the judge to be sent to a place where he can receive mental health treatment, acting as if he were the victim of his own choices and needed help. So he picked up on the letter writing campaign that his mother had done the first time he was in prison. And his strategy at this point in time is to claim his own innocence. So he writes the judge claiming that he's not guilty, that he was incapable of committing rape. He reasoned that since he was an inmate with fear and pain as a violent, I messed up my own sentence. His reasoning was that since he was an inmate with fear and pain as a violent rapist, he would therefore be unwilling to inflict those emotional states on others.
That's stupid.
It's not how that works, buddy. Not how that works. So because you have fear and pain being an inmate, you couldn't possibly transfer that onto other people? Okay.
Just the manipulation here. Uh-huh. This is not a person who appears to have any type of a cognitive impairment at all.
Or remorse or anything
There's
like that.
There's clearly no remorse. Yeah. It's all about him. He just made himself the victim.
Yes, he's the victim.
In a violent rape. Mm-hmm. The second violent rape.
He said that the judge's sentence was too harsh, that some letters, in some letters he tried to say he was innocent. Other letters he was attacking the prison system for his victimized, you know, way of life. He's a victim of the prison system. And so that's the frame of mind that he's using to write these letters. He also complained to state government officials that he was entitled to more education and social benefits. He even complained that the prison wages weren't making enough money in interest.
Do you think anybody thought about giving his victim a really nice paying job and paying for her education from having been violently assaulted by him?
Nope.
Think anybody thought about maybe making sure she got a fair wage or good opportunity at a job? Just wondered.
Meals, all those
Everything
things.
Everything paid for. Mm-hmm.
So it played into his idea that he was a victim, but writing letters also passed the time. Mostly, he held down various jobs in prison and took some technical classes, and he waited for Carol to come by for a visit.
Who's Carol? One of the wardens?
It's funny nurse? That you say that. My next line is, bet you want to know who Carol is, huh?
I hope she's a jail rat, like an actual one with whiskers.
Oh, if only. If only he had friended a real rat like on Charlotte's Web. No, instead, Carol Patterson. She's a real person. She's a mother of four, divorced, and from what I can tell, she's had about as many brain cells as she does children.
She fell victim to manipulation and fancied herself in love.
Yeah, she heard of David from a friend who had a husband in the same prison.
You know, I know this really nice guy she'd set with up with. He only sexually assaults young girls.
Yeah, you're totally safe.
And only like two.
You know, I know this cute guy. He's single. He's doing 12 years for his second rape offense. But I think you two would totally hit it off.
Ladies, none of you should be answering any letters from prison or writing to prisoners. If you want to know about their true crime stories, write to us.
Yeah, we'll research the shit out of that and let you know. We'll air it out.
Don't write to people in prison. Although we should start.
Oh, well, we do have someone that we have covered on the podcast that would like to be featured.
Oh, that's right. I recall.
I think we should do it.
I don't know if you want me to be part of that.
Be very interesting. So Carol first met him in October 1975, and she became a regular visitor. I'm sure this means conjugal. To the point where she moved to Beaver Dam so that she could be closer to make her daily visits at the state prison.
That's a lot of visits.
Yeah.
Daily? That doesn't happen here. You're not getting daily visits. You get a visit day maybe once a week or once every other week.
They apparently let her visit daily at that time. She believed that David Spanbauer was innocent of the rape charges that put him behind bars.
Because she was there.
Many tried to convince her that he was very guilty. Even her own social worker. But she was going to believe what she wanted to believe. So Carol Patterson fancies herself a rapist. And the two get hitched.
A rapist? Oh, she fancies a rapist. Like, she fancies him.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, I'm fancies herself a rapist. Like, she thought she was one. I'm like, what am I missing?
I'm so sorry.
Jesus, you scared the hell out of me.
No. Okay. To my knowledge, she hasn't raped
anybody. She fancies him.
Yeah.
And marries herself a rapist.
She sure does. July 1976, they get married.
It's beautiful.
Yes, love through those prison bars.
And he's got four stepchildren now. Or any of them daughters.
Oh, we'll get there.
God.
So.
Bless it.
David thinks having a wife is another way to manipulate the parole board.
I've changed.
He sent some more letters. You're going to find this so disgusting.
Great.
He sent more letters to prison officials and Judge Bardwell, who by now is probably really regretting his decision. Because he has been bombarded by this letters from this man.
You say a couple of nice things about a serial rapist and all of a sudden you're their best friend.
Yeah, exactly. So he's now using his status as a married man as an angle. He claimed that because of family obligations, he was entitled to an early release because his new 13-year-old stepdaughter needed parental guidance.
Ew.
Yes. That's what I said. Carol not only had four children, but she had a 13-year-old daughter. Thank Christ that the parole board did not fall for this and it did not work. Carol and David were divorced within 2 years.
Well, it's hard to be married to somebody you're never going to get to take to family events.
You know, Christmas is lonely.
We have Christmas at the prison this year.
Again.
And I bet her ex-husband wasn't a fan of having her take the four kids there. Maybe she was a widow.
No, she was a divorcee.
Okay.
Nope, she was
a divorcee. Oh, you did say that.
By 1978, now he's a divorcee himself, and Carol's twice divorced by the age of 32.
That one didn't count.
And the women in his life were leaving him because while he was in prison, well, his younger sister died. Remember, he was the oldest of two.
That's tragic. I feel terrible. She didn't do anything wrong.
Can you imagine how
fun her life was?
Nope. I hope that she stayed pretty protected away from most of David's
imagine she had much protection with a mother that thinks that young women are asking for it.
That's a good point. And also her dad died when she was really
young. Feel terrible
for her. Because David was 14.
Yeah.
But Evelyn, She dies too. Mom? So we don't feel bad. Yeah. Evelyn, the mom, she croaked while he was in prison the second time.
Can we talk more
too.
About the innocent young sister that passed away?
Sure, sure, sure. For,
yeah. Okay.
Evelyn, so, but Evelyn's not there to fight for him at the parole board anymore.
He has no female support. He's lost his mother, his wife, his sister.
Yep.
He has one more younger sister though.
Yeah. But I don't know that she was coming to his aid.
Probably.
At all.
No, she was like, I'm out.
There was no mention of her. No. So I don't know that she wanted to.
And if she's around anywhere or her family members are, God bless you. We hope you're doing well.
Yeah. In prison, David was treated for his sexual perversions and mental problems. He spent some time in group therapy, and mostly it seems that this was a ploy to receive a get out of jail early card. In 1986, when he was denied parole again, he swore he was done dealing with shrinks and their evaluations and their therapies. He even thought that the psychologists were getting more out of the therapy sessions than him because he was smarter than they were. Sure.
I know
sure,
how you feel, David.
Sure. Okay. He continued to pine for early parole and continued to mention his former wife as part of his plan for making a positive life once he got out.
I'm going to stalk my wife?
Yeah.
Ex-wife?
His
and
ex-wife.
Her children that aren't mine?
He planned on moving in with her.
Did she want that?
I don't think so. She divorced him. But nothing could scheme the parole board. So they continually refused his parole until they no longer could because the mandatory release date was January 29th, 1991. Because remember, he was only given 12 years.
I recall.
He left prison with $8,000 in savings from his prison work. And moved in with his sister, Judy. Oh, I forgot. Judy is mentioned in here.
Oh, okay. So he did move in with her.
I totally forgot about
that's
that.
That's okay. But now that $8,000 that he had most likely would have all been taken and it would have been utilized to pay his restitution and things like that for to his victim. Because I don't know that any restitution was ordered or any compensation for her. Like, who was paying for her therapy and for her mental health right. needs after she was horribly
yep.
raped?
Yep. So Judy was married to Clark Tadich, an Oshkosh police officer.
Oh, God.
It was a temporary stay, and once he got settled in with a job at the local 7-Up bottling plant, he moved into an apartment of his own on the west side of Oshkosh. So I get the impression that... can you imagine this guy, like Clark, being like, so your rapist brother needs a place to stay.
Who's out on parole and he's going to stay with me. And in the meantime, he's talking to his chief of police going, please don't fire me. My yeah. wife, man.
Right, exactly.
This Things are tough at home right now.
You can't pick your family. You know? And so I know. At this time, when people were out on parole, they would have to file written reports on their comings and goings. So he would write where he's been, what he's up to, and then I thought this was
because
funny.
They often write, I went behind the Piggly Wiggly and raped an 11-year-old.
Isn't that so stupid? Like,
well,
I
we
just,
have tethers now, but.
Yeah, but at the time we had to do something, right? So this
it's the honor system.
Yeah, 1991, man, crazy times. This is funny, though. At the end of all of his parole writings where he was, like, talking about where he's been and what he's been doing, he would write, smile. At the end of each report, which just reminds me of like in today's terms, you know how people put a smiley emoji at the end of a text?
He was emojiing.
He was 1991 emojiing. On Christmas Eve of 1991, David had a heart attack, and for a moment, there was no heartbeat. But
was there even a heart?
The doctors brought him back to life because, you know, they pledged to do no harm. Yeah. Not even to rapists.
It's okay. No, they can't. They have yeah. to save everyone. And we want that. We do. We want people to be saved because I don't want some doctor who doesn't know me making a decision as to whether or not I get to live or not. That's not for them to make that decision.
All right.
Okay. All right.
That's fair.
Thank
Fine.
You. I'm sorry for Fine. Making sense today.
The pig has spoken.
Transition.
Ugh. Transition.
Pig transition.
Pig transition. That you're right.
It's fine.
You're right. They saved David Shithead. It was the right thing to do.
Tell us how you really blah, feel, Charnel. Blah, she was blah. All worried about my feelings in this case, and she's clearly
no,
more upset
my,
than
right.
I am.
So he worked early mornings.
Fucking
and
Hippocratic.
He worked early mornings and finished up mid-afternoon after at the bottling plant. He would go to a nearby tavern. He'd have himself some brewskis.
Well, you don't typically allow that on parole, but they're in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It's like water.
I'm not saying it was allowed, but that's what he would do. Also, he wouldn't get drunk. So he would just like slow and steady.
Yeah, he was just having a few. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Actually, the tavern people, thought he was a nice guy. Because he's not raping people in front of them.
No, and you don't check everybody's criminal history that comes in your bar. Otherwise, you won't have a business.
I was just going to say, please don't do that. You will go out of business.
Yeah, and you'll make yourself sad.
Yes, yes. So let's talk about, is it pronounced Winneconne? Winneconne, Wisconsin?
Spell it.
Oh, W-I-N-N-E-C-O-N-N-E. Winneconne?
Yeah, Winneconne. I think Winneconne? It's Winneconne.
It could go either way there. In Michigan, boy, we would pronounce it Winneconne in Michigan, but it might be different in good old Wisconsin. So regardless, it's a small town of the Fox Valley region, and it's not far from David's like known roaming. Okay. He's kind of like a skunk that just roams in like a certain mile radius. And here, Megan, in the early 1990s, women started to disappear.
Okay, great. Again.
Yep. The first one we're going to talk about is 20-year-old Laura DePries. She lived in Winneconne, or maybe it's Winneconne.
It's not Winneconne. They laugh when you say that. I'm looking it up right now. I'm pretty sure it's I think I'm right. I think it's Winneconne.
Okay. That's how we would say it in Michigan. It is. Yeah. Okay. Cool, cool, cool. She worked at the Fox River Mall in Grand Chute, and when she finished her shift on August 19th, 1992, she went over to visit her friends, and she never showed up. Her friends found her locked in their apartment parking lot. David Spanbauer just started his summer vacation the day before. She is still missing to this day.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep. So the only thing that they have found is her locked car in the apartment parking lot. Another girl disappeared. Her bicycle was found near the rural home in Ripton in Fondue, Lac County, on August 23rd, 1992. 6 weeks later, her body was found 100 miles away in a cornfield ditch near Tower Hill State Park, not far from the Wisconsin River. Her name was Ronelle Eichsheet.
Jesus Christ.
It's spelled, Google Translate was a little weird on this one. But it's Eichsheet.
Okay. It's something that's like Swedish or, you know, because we're all of us Northerners up here have some Scandinavian blood.
Yeah. Eichsheedt. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she was 10 years old.
Shite.
No, that is not how.
Not shite.
That's not how Google Translate said it, because that's how I thought it was too. It was a hard DT.
Sheet. Okay.
So she's 10 years old. Okay.
So he's gotten better.
Well, here.
Because these people are missing to this day, these little babies. No,
the only one that's missing is Laura.
Okay.
At this point, hold on.
Okay.
Let me get through the names and stuff. So David had actually sexually assaulted and killed her. He used his 1988 four-door Eagle Premier to transport her body. He sold that and later bought a maroon 1991 Buick Pontiac Bonneville. Almost 2 years later, and I'm sure that there are more people between August 23rd and 1992 and 4th of July 1994, but we just don't know about them. But the next one that we know about is 4th of July 1994, 24-year-old Miriam Starha was riding her bike on a county road near Hartman Creek State Park when a maroon Pontiac actually like banged into her bike enough to make her crash.
Ugh.
David emerges from the car. He said he was trying to scare her and he held a pistol. Another car coming down the road slowed down. David got back in his car and drove away. So Miriam reported the incident to the police. The FBI hired a professional artist from California to sketch out the suspect's features in one of the six pictures of what they thought the attacker might look like, including a side profile. State and federal investigators in charge of the case were unsure if they had reliable composite drawings, and they decided only to release the sketches to involved law enforcement bodies instead of the public at this time because they just weren't sure they were accurate. They had already had plenty of leads to follow up on, and special agents didn't want to flood bad tips coming in if the sketch was shown to the public, which makes sense. However, David was loving life through the summer and autumn of 1994. It was the longest stint of freedom he had ever tasted since he was 19 years old. And he exploited it. For him, robbery, rape, and murder were addicting. His crime spree continued through the Fox Valley region. He burglarized homes with the intention of there being no confrontation, just a matter of getting the goods in and out. But if there was a person, he would produce a pistol and finish the robbery at gunpoint. On July 9th, less than a week later after he attacked Miriam, he broke into a home in Appleton armed with a handgun. He thought no one was home, but he found a 21-year-old Trudy Jasecki in a bedroom and fired one shot into her chest. She would have been a witness. She did die from the bullet wound. And he later ditched the gun in a park in Oshkosh. Menominee Park, as a matter of fact. On Labor Day, September 5th, a 12-year-old girl named Cora Jones from nearby rode her bike on Sanders Road near her grandma's house in the township of Dayton. It wasn't far from the place where David ran into Miriam with his car. Remember how he crashed into her bike?
Yes, to scare her.
Mm-hmm. David forced Cora into his car. He sexually assaulted her. And then he drove 75 miles north to Langlade County near Kempster. And there had been basically 5 or 6 hours that transpired from when he picked Cora up to when he ended her life. He strangled and stabbed her and threw her body in a steep ditch. So police organized a search for her using a country church for the headquarters. Hundreds of volunteers helped canvass the surrounding woods in a 10-mile like perimeter, and the FBI joined the case. Cora's body was found 5 days later.
Okay.
His attacks continued and occurred with regularity. On October 20th, 1994, he raped a 15-year-old girl, and on November 5th, he raped a 31-year-old woman in Appleton area. By now...
Like, in her house?
Mm-hmm. By now, the Sheriff's Department, Wapaka County Sheriff's Department...
Wapaka?
Probably.
No, I know.
And the
I know my Wiscos.
Langlade County Sheriff's Department, the FBI, and the Wisconsin Department of Justice Division of Criminal Investigations were on the case. Suspecting the string of assaults and murders are obviously not a coincidence. So, Combined Locks is a small Wisconsin town named after the boat locks on the Fox River.
Yeah.
It was a quiet place and not a place of crime. Until November 14th, 1994, when Gerald Argall went to his home in Combined Locks and discovered a man breaking into his house. He ran after the man and tackled and wrestled the man. Now, okay. The man that he was tackling and wrestling was a 53-year-old man. This is David.
Okay.
He wrestled him into submission, and when the police arrive, they arrest him on burglary charges. While in custody, the police noticed that the tools found in his car matched those used in two home invasions that included rape that had happened earlier in the fall. The police kept up their interrogation, and after 4 days, he confessed in the presence of his attorney, Tom Zosch, to kidnapping and killing the two little girls and for the shooting death of Trudy.
Okay.
Langlade County Sheriff David Steger said that his confession contained details that only the killer would know about and felt he's our guy.
Yeah.
So...
Why confess this time? This is a guy who doesn't take accountability for anything. Just because he was so obviously busted.
But remember the last time that he got busted and was interrogated, he broke under interrogation and confessed? The first time that he went to prison?
He did, but there was love there, remember? They cried together. He raped her.
No, that was the second time.
Oh.
Yeah.
The first time he broke.
He broke and confessed to the attempted rape and then the full-on rape where he shot somebody in the face.
You're right.
Uh-huh.
Forgot that one, ma'am.
Uh-huh. Well, there's so many.
Well, at least the details of
it. It's hard to keep it straight. There's so many.
So he broke this time, too.
He did. He also matched the composite sketch picture.
And he was found with burglar's tools. Uh-huh. I mean, when you start, press play, roll tape, open trunk.
The other thing is his vehicle matched the one that knocked Miriam off her bike. An analysis of the carpet fiber found on the body of Cora Jones was a match to the carpet of David's Pontiac Bonneville as well. However, David was cleared of any connection to the 1992 case of Laura DePies.
Really?
Whose body is still not found.
What year did that happen
1992. Yeah.
Okay.
So David Spanbauer's crimes ranged through 5 counties, and each county prosecutor wanted a piece of him, of course.
Got it.
His attorney negotiated that 18 charges be consolidated at one venue, and the case landed into the Outagamie County and into the lap of prosecutor Vince. Oh, gosh, Vince. Why do you have to have a complicated last name?
Wisconsin's like Michigan. We've got all kinds of weird indigenous populations to create these names. And place names are all so Native hard. American. They're yeah. All, yeah.
It's amazing, but hard. So there are wanted posters of him on, there's wanted posters in this courthouse where he was tried. One of them hanging up at the time of the trial asked for information about Trudy's case and volunteered a $10,000 reward for tips that led to her killer's capture, and also for Laura, who he's been cleared of. During the proceedings, of course, his attorney described him as a festering soul and a coward, and asked him to turn to face the courtroom audience. And I actually meant the prosecutor. I think I accidentally said the defense.
Yeah.
My bad. Because Biskupic is the prosecutor, not his attorney. So Biskupic was like, listen, you're a festering soul. You're a coward. And I want you to face the courtroom audience so that they can see that you are evil and pathetic and face these victims' families that are stricken with grief. Of course, David did not do that, and he said nothing. At 53 years old, he looked a lot older. He had a lot of gray hair. He was thin. He had the appearance of an oaf that spent 35 years of adulthood in prison, quite frankly. And his attorney said that his client was sane, and he knows his client is sane because he's feeling remorse for his crimes.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
The insane don't feel remorse?
I guess not. I guess that's what his attorney is insinuating. But on Thursday, December 8th, 1994, David pled no contest to 2 charges and guilty to the remaining 16 charges. He was found guilty for first-degree intentional homicide in the Cora Jones and the Ronell murders, and then guilty on all the other counts. He was sentenced on December 20th. That was a quick sentencing, really. The courtroom was packed to see what his fate would be. It was full of families of Cora, Ronell, and Trudy, and also families of David's 2 previous rape victims. Good. It was standing room only, and it was even on TV. And you will resonate with this judge a lot better, Megan. Circuit Judge James had no leniency at all, and there was no speculation of any innate goodness that might be left and coaxed out of David in any kind of rehabilitation. This judge said, quote, "I don't know from what cesspool in hell you slithered forth, and I can't send you back."
Oh, my God.
End quote. And he speculated that it couldn't possibly be the God that they believed in that would, quote, "let a piece of awful like you walk this earth."
That's shit.
End quote.
That means shit.
Sure does. That's judge talk for shit. I know. A piece of awful. He took into account the life expectancies of Cora Jones, Ronell, and Trudy to calculate the time that he deserved to be in prison, and he was handed 3 life terms plus the maximum consecutive sentences on the other crimes for a total of 403 years.
Dang.
His earliest possible time that he could be a free man would be December 20th, 2191.
That is the only possible safe way to have sentenced him. Uh-huh. I mean, that was a great sentence. This is a man who every single time he perpetrated a horrific crime was given another chance and even committed crimes while he was under supervision every time and then still given another chance. That is such a justice system failure in the time that it makes us. I mean, you have better jurists now because of cases like this where we get education so that we don't make freaking dumb decisions like that. A second judge.
Right.
And the first judge gave him a very appropriate sentence, by the way.
He did.
I was impressed with that for the time.
He did.
But he made parole.
He made parole.
Because of his age. And I'm not even saying that was wrong, okay? There's a lot of times that younger prisoners are let out to see if they're potentially rehabilitatable. Now, I didn't hear anything that would indicate he was rehabilitatable. What I heard was that he met the percentage statutory-wise to let a person out.
Let him out. Yep.
So he was let out for that. Not because he was a viable option for parole. Mm-mm. He commits a horrific crime then. Ends up being given a very light sentence for a criminal sexual conduct act, 12 years.
Because he didn't shoot somebody this time during the rape that he was not interrupted in.
And because the victim was blamed. Uh-huh. She was asking for it. This is not okay. Nope. There are so many protections put in place for this now. He becomes a serial killer.
Even worse. And I feel like all of those preventable deaths and crimes are on the hands of that ridiculous light sentence that was given to him. It's awful. Here's the other thing, though. He knew that prison life wasn't going to go well for him, okay? And that he would probably end up dead. And it's at this time, this is why.
What a horrible feeling he must feel to know that he could be put in a position where someone might hurt or kill him. I wonder what all his victims felt.
Exactly. Think of the time frame, though. This is where his concern is coming from. 1994, Wisconsin's most vicious serial killer and boy rapist, the Milwaukee cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer, had been doing time in the Columbia Correctional Institute in Portage.
He wasn't interested in you.
While working janitorial duties with two other convicts, he was found dead with a crushed skull. His fellow inmate, Christopher Scarver, beat him to death with a broom handle. So that's where he's coming from of, that's going to happen to me. He wanted to save himself from being shanked, essentially. So he was sent to the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Faribault, Minnesota, a medium security prison. While serving his time there, he returned back to Appleton for a secret court hearing in early December 1998. At that time,
secret court hearing? Was he seeking some type of amnesty or something?
I don't
like
know.
Like a compassionate release?
I don't know. I told you it was secret. I'm not sure.
We don't know the results of this hearing?
No, his health was poor at the time, but he made the trip to inform the police where he ditched the murder weapon in the 1994 Trudy case.
Did he admit to killing her then?
Well, yeah, he was already found because that was one of them that he pled no contest.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Trudy, yeah, okay.
Yep. Menominee Park in Oshkosh, he told them, and with the accurate details, the police located the gun within half an hour. In October 2000, he was secretly transferred back over the state line to Dodge Correctional Institution, where his lawyer didn't know about the transfer, only that the letters they exchanged mysteriously stopped that autumn, so he was informed that his presence in Wisconsin by a journalist when the story broke in the early media in early, I didn't mean early media, I meant broke in the local media in early May 2001 that the killer was back in the state. The reason cited for the move was that he was suffering from heart problems and that the prison where he was at could not attend to his medical condition because he needed a 24-hour like nursing staff. So his lawyer was pretty pissed that, like, I wasn't informed that my client was being transferred back across state lines.
But they transferred him for his own health care needs because he was at a medium security prison where they clearly didn't have, nurses available 24/7.
No. And he died Monday, July 29th, 2002, at Dodge Correctional Institution. He was pronounced dead at 4:25 p.m. in a prison hospital. The autopsy showed that he had liver disease and heart disease, and those were the causes of death. And he had signed a DNR order. In a related legal battle in 1996 regarding crime reporting and freedom of information, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel
and JTM, I'm sorry, M, wow, I'm tired. WTMJ is what I'm trying to say, news radio. They sued the state of Wisconsin for withholding the prison records of David, along with Dahmer and his killer, Christopher Scarver, and Jesse Anderson, a murder the other murderer associated with Dahmer's death.
Yeah.
So
I recall this.
Yeah. There was another party that wanted to know more about David's release from prison, and that is that of Carol Grady. She spent most of her life believing that David would be behind bars for the crimes that he perpetrated on her in 1960. She is the 16-year-old that I didn't mention before because she was 16. Mm-hmm. When the news of his 1994 arrest was broadcast, she was stunned and she felt like a victim again.
Yeah.
Because she thought he'd be 86 years old when he was finally released from his 70-year sentence. So, disgusted and horrified that she was never notified of his earlier release, she campaigned in for truth in sentencing and victims' rights advocacy.
Love it.
In May 1997, an in-truth sentencing proposal arrived, and it was spearheaded by Carol Grady, with a petition holding thousands of signatures. Felons would serve the time they are given, no early releases, and they would serve a community supervision term that is a minimum of a quarter of their prison sentence. 20 years in prison would mean 20 years. The proposal met with wide support from political parties and each end of the spectrum. By the spring of 1998, the Wisconsin Senate passed a bill dubbed Two Strikes, You're Out. It was designated for those that commit crimes against children. If convicted twice, the offender would receive a life sentence. The bill encompassed sexual assault, kidnapping, false imprisonment, incest, and nearly all forms of sexual exploitation or exposure.
Beautiful.
Yes.
That's great reform.
Right?
Great reform.
And Miss Grady had a, you know, she spearheaded that after what had happened to her and that he had got out from his 70-year sentence so early.
Because of a rule that was only that you serve mm-hmm. a percentage of your time.
Yes, exactly. And she wanted that changed and she got it changed. So
I liked this.
Yeah, this was a crazy case. I guess I did not realize that his case was like right up against Dahmer's at the time and why time people wanted that. So
and maybe he wasn't as highly publicized as he should have been because as a serial rapist and murderer, he was totally overshadowed by Dahmer at that point in time.
Oh, definitely.
So
and his death, Dahmer's
yeah,
death.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I have a follow-up brain bath for you.
A follow-up brain
I do.
Bath?
I cannot remember if it was a Patreon episode or if it was a general episode. So y'all just have to bear with me and look it up if you've not heard it before. But do you remember I once brought you an attorney who got his
license taken away because he was throwing poop at people?
In a Pringles can?
In Indiana.
Yes, ma'am.
Or Ohio.
Ohio.
It
was Ohio. Yep.
My neighbors to the south.
Yep. Our neighbors to the south where I am.
Do you have an update on
this? I have an update. Okay. I have an update for you on Jack Blakeslee's suspension. It's an update from June 20th, 2024.
Oh.
An Ohio attorney has reclaimed his license to practice law after admitting to throwing a can of his own feces into a victim advocacy center's parking lot. Jack Blakeslee, a Coleridge lawyer with over 40 years of experience, previously had his license suspended in November 2023 by the Ohio Supreme Court. The group of judges had charged him with professional misconduct after he threw a feces-filled Pringles can in 2021 at the property of Haven of Hope. The Cambridge Victims Advocacy Center was scheduled to appear against him the same day in court for a capital murder trial. The attorney was barred from practicing law as part of a one-year suspension over the case, but the court had held off on enforcing 6 months of that punishment as long as he did not engage in any further misconduct. After receiving an application from Blakeslee on Monday, the Ohio Supreme Court's disciplinary counsel decided to reinstate his license on Tuesday.
Oh.
When it first decided to suspend his license, the court said a Haven of Hope surveillance camera, as one of its employees, witnessed the lawyer throw the Pringles can into the lot. He had passed through an alleyway by the center twice in his car and drove to the Guernsey County Courthouse for the 8:30 a.m. trial after throwing his feces. Remember, these people were about to appear in court against him.
I'm aware.
He took his morning shit in a Pringles can, threw it at the very people that would be going against him that morning in court.
Testifying against his client. Yes. Not him. He wasn't in trouble. Well, he was trying the Dean case.
The Board of Professional Conduct for the Ohio Supreme Court reported that there was clear evidence the attorney had committed the misconduct before suspending him. Blakeslee also explained in a disposition for the case that he threw the feces-filled can to blow off steam. What kind of steam do you have at 8:30 a.m.? Are you angry about being alive?
Steamy feces.
He called his misconduct a prank that was stupid. He admitted to throwing cans of his feces multiple times in the past.
I know, I remember that.
However, he said he wasn't targeting anyone specific and would throw them at random from his car.
This is why we don't God. Like Ohio State. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Ohio. It is a
you
very
you
boring
of them
state.
And an MSU fan here. You and we're do. Both like, oh, how I hate Ohio State.
Great. Gosh. Yeah, they reinstated his license.
I mean, I'm not surprised. If he had, can you imagine this guy's had an impeccable record? He's practiced law for 40-some years, and then he literally
he just hasn't been getting caught flinging his feces.
Well,
that's
what the evidence in front of me.
But he admitted to it. I've done it several times. What's the big deal? I often poop in cans and bags and throw it at random. What kind of mental disturbance do you have?
It's a little embarrassing.
It should be. It's embarrassing to humans, not just lawyers, just humans in general, that you would find the need to plop a deuce into some sort of apparatus that you're throwing at other humans to blow off steam. Go to the gym and get a punching bag. I don't know. Go engage in bukkake with your lover.
Ew, Charnel. Well, this is a general audience episode. Your tender ears don't even know what that means. Any of you that option. Google that, you better use the incognito tab.
It's a option that could satisfy the whim. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I'm just saying, I hope you're never on any like tenure commission that I'm aware of.
My God.
Now, I feel bad for the advocacy center. That's not okay. You should expect better behavior than that from everybody involved. So
yes. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode, even though it was full of murder and poop.
It was.
I'm sorry about that.
And you told me to begin with that David was a shithead, and I did. You started us with shit and you ended us with shit.
Do you like how I bring everything around full circle?
You do.
I have a real knack for that.
Yeah. Thanks for the 360 podcasting.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And it's time to sign off now. So with that, thank you all for listening. We hope that you keep it curious.
And keep listening.
Till next time. Bye-bye.